So I'm not sure I quite follow that. So you called in, the listeners called in to KDWB, and what happened?
Actually, I think they had to send a card, a postcard, and I think it was drawn out of a hopper, and then KDWB called them back and said, are you ready to roll right now? Because we're going to put this call through to Seville, Spain, or, you know, Istanbul, or whatever, you know. And if I remember, I think that's the way it went.
And then they would broadcast the conversation.
They would broadcast the conversation prior to, and then they would broadcast the hookup. You know, it's like, Earl, this is your daughter, you know, Jane in Minneapolis. And then Earl's surprise. And then the disc jockey would step in and say, okay, you guys are on private now. And then somehow, I can't remember the rest of it, but it was kind of a unique contest.
So they didn't broadcast the whole conversation on the air.
No.
But they hooked people up with relatives wherever they may be.
Right, exactly. And it's funny because you think about it now, and there wasn't phone service. I mean, you're talking landlines or undersea lines. Mm-hmm. Hell, there wasn't phone service to some of these places. For instance, I don't think at that point in time you could have called Jakarta. Or someplace, you know, way down in Southeast Asia. Who knows? You might have been able to, but...
Now, at WDGY and KDWB, did you also go out and promote local bands when they played live?
The only local band I really promoted was Still Roman. I'm trying to think. Oh, yeah, actually, I ended up with a group at Mr. Lucky's. Was it Mr. Lucky's day? Was that the restaurant portion of it, or was that the ballroom?
New City Opera House before it turned to New City Opera House. So yeah, it was Lucky's next door to Magoo's.
Well, I had the pizza side. I ended up with a group called the Outsiders, and they were a one hit wonder. But that's about the only thing I can remember. I actually made some money on the deal.
Oh, the Outsiders from Time Won't Let Me?
Yeah, Time Won't Let Me on Capitol.
From Ohio.
Yeah, and they were stuck in town for some reason and needed a gig. Hmm. Either their agent or somebody called me, and I called the owner of Mr. Lucky's, and what was his name? I can't remember.
Gary Jorgensen?
Yeah, might have been.
Yes, he was Magoo's.
And he said, yeah, we can give you the pizza stage. And I just charged cash. I mean, there was no time to print tickets or anything. I think I charged $3 or $4 at the door and stamped them on the back of the hand and threw the pizza. It was just filled. And I had probably a day and a half to put radio on, and that's all I did. I bought both KDWB and DGY and just bought very minimal schedule, but that's all I did, and made quite a bit of dough.
Now, Magoo's was the side with pizza and the 3-2 beer?
Yeah.
Is that how that worked?
Yeah. And it was big, though. I mean, it held some people. Let me tell you, what did you say, 500? Probably.
I don't recall it being that big, but...
Well, it was big, though.
Several hundred, probably.
It was separated. The liquor side, they had just kind of a half wall separating, so people underage could be in there, but then if you wanted to drink beer, you had to prove you were... What was the age at the time? Was it 21 or 18 at that time?
18 at that time.
Yeah,
I don't know. Both sides, it was. They ran every night of the week, and it was pretty busy place.
It was quite
the
place. Boy. It was really wild.
Kind of interesting, because I believe the Still Roving played Time Won't Let Me by the Outsiders.
We did our version. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In fact, I think every garage band in America did.
It's a great tune for bass players, eh, Denny?
Tell us a little bit about Hawaii and Puerto Rico, will you? The conversation.
Well, I was living with a Swedish girl in Puerto Rico, and how the hell I met up with her. She came from Gothenburg. Beautiful, but big. Man, she was a big gal. I mean, I'm just proportioned. You know, don't get me wrong, but she was just big. We lived in Viejo San Juan, which is the old San Juan, and we lived above La Perla, and La Perla translates to the pearl, and we were in this old area of forts built in the 1600s, 1500s, 1600s. We would look down over La Perla. That was a slums. Boy, that was some tough stuff down there. You didn't dare go down there. I mean, you know, you'd lose your life. The guy that bought this building was a former machine gun setter on World War II propeller-driven aircraft, primarily the P-51s, and he would set the 50 caliber machine guns to either shoot straight or shoot all into the middle. And he made a lot of money doing it. And he had a gorgeous wife. God, she was pretty. And he restored stuff. He restored these old 16th century buildings. And I lived in a wonderful apartment. And it's kind of funny because you have either an open window or a shuttered window. You have no screens, no glass, no screens, no nothing. It's either a wooden shutter or it's wide open. And you'd sleep with the thing open. It was kind of nice. And then Hawaii, I worked there for Tom Moffat at Kapoi. And I worked with some wonderful guys there. God. And some of them, I also can remember Kapoi newsmen read and recommend the Honolulu Advertiser, which was in competition with the Honolulu something or other, Star Bulletin. Then they would go off to Japan. Or if they had a degree, you know, they'd end up in Guam and making big, big government money at the time. So that was a really fun place to work. And I worked with a guy named, can't think of it. I think it's Tom Tyler. He opened up a thing called Commercial Recording Studio, which is much like this, and absolutely made a fortune. There was, here you have a city that's growing like a weed, which Honolulu was at the time, filled with ad agencies, and no place to record. I mean, all you could do is go to the local radio station and hope they weren't busy doing their own stuff and buy a little space or a little time. Well, Tom did very, very well for himself. He's out of it now. And I'm trying to think of another guy. God, there were some funny guys there.
What was the format there?
45 RPM, AM, rock and roll.
Top 40?
Yeah, absolutely, top 40.
How long did you stay in Hawaii?
4 years, 2 years and 2 years, or maybe 3 years and 3 years. And I lived mostly in Waikiki, but I lived a little bit around. If you go around the front of Diamond Head and go around to the other side, there was a place back there that was called, the hell was it, Bachelor's Paradise or something. I lived in a house that was built in 1920, probably, with a bunch of other guys, and had outbuildings on it. And in fact, I lived in one of the outbuildings with this beautiful big lawn that stretched right to the sea. I mean, you could just walk right at the end of your lawn and go jump in the Pacific Ocean. It was the damnedest thing you ever saw. And of course, now it's hotels. But boy, were there, there was so many women in that place, you just wouldn't believe it. Because I remember I was in the Marine Corps Reserves, and I was at Marine Barracks Pearl Harbor for my station. That's where I had to go report in. And the Vietnamese War was just really starting to crank up. And I mean, I was in fear of being called at all times, and I was available at all times. And the DIs would come into our barracks that we would stay overnight at and stay for the weekend or for the weeks and say, all right, you son of a bitches, pack your sea bags because you're going to Vietnam. You're going to be in Saigon in 24 hours. Never happened. Just never happened. And why? I don't know. I was in a Marine Corps recon outfit, and we were trained. We were trained up in the hills. We'd black face and swim around where you shouldn't. And, you know, a lot of the guys jumped. Not me, but a lot of the guys went to Army jump school in Guam.
In between KDWB and WDGY?
Yeah, because I had a two-year window. I had 4 years in Hawaii, but I had a two-year window. And they would put me on the train in Minneapolis and get me up to Winnipeg. And at the time, you just go into Winnipeg. I mean, nobody was checking.
Who's they?
The station. They had a trade out with Air Canada. And so I'd have to pay my own way to Winnipeg on the train. It was a delightful deal. I mean, God, when train service was good, I mean, I'd go in and get pleasantly stewed in the club car and get a little roomette or something and fall asleep. And in the morning,
roomette.
Yeah, but they're
hold them.
Yeah, and then, you know, take a cab to the airport, and I was off again onto Hawaii. But
well, let me ask you this.
God, I can't put the chronology of these jobs. There's so damn many of them.
Well, let me ask you this: how would you compare living in Hawaii to living in Minnesota?
They both have their ups, they both have their downs. And living in Hawaii, there's one thing about it, that after 2 years, you feel so constrained that, I mean, remember, you're on an island, once you've seen point A and point B and C and D, you finally say, geez, I've seen this before and seen it a lot. And now it's, I understand it's really crowded in Honolulu and the traffic is awful. When I was there, God, it was just so pleasant.
A little different winters there, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, obviously the winters were nice. And I would, inevitably, I'd end up there in the winter, which was, you know, and all of a sudden you get into your room and you hear mourning doves are cooing in the trees, you know. And you say, Jesus, you just left a hell of a snowstorm. And if you guys have ever left Winnipeg, I want to tell you, Winnipeg is just one of the cold places on earth. Yeah, so it was very pleasant.
Let's talk about the Stilroven. Do you recall the very first time you heard of the Stilroven or saw them play?
They did an open audition for an outfit I was working for at the time. And if you can remember the date, then I can get the date put to Stage Finders, because that's where I was working for at the time. And that was a booking agency, and that was up against the Dick Shapiro and Bill Deal.
Central Booking?
Central Booking, and they were operating out of the towers in downtown Minneapolis.
Where was Stage Finders, where were they out of?
They were out of the Magoo's up above area.
And who ran that company?
That was run by Bill Roslansky. Bill didn't really know what he was doing, but he learned a lot on the job.
So where did the band audition?
We auditioned at Mr. Lucky's, and I believe it had to be 66, because by 67 we were already recording, so it had to be sometime in 1966,
yeah.
And then
yeah, because Dan and Rocky were still with the band at that point.
Yeah, it was the original band, Dan and Rock, Dave and I and John, and we started getting gigs right away. I mean, once we got the audition, we passed the audition. We kind of found out pretty quick. I don't know how fast, but we ran down, got the union cards. Pete sent us out to buy two outfits. We had a couple sets of clothes.
Where'd you go to buy the outfits?
We started out. I don't remember if we bought these at John Stevens. Yeah, we bought them at John. We bought flowered shirts and dark pants and jackets.
At John Stevens?
No, I can't remember if we got the shirts. Well, they were flowered shirts. I think that's when John Stevens had just opened up, because our next set of outfits we bought were full suits, like Beatles suits. And it was the second floor right up of the elevator of Dayton's in the men's department. And right off to the side, there was a guy from England there. It was a room probably the size of this. Well, maybe twice this room size, not real large. Huh? And they had the coolest clothes ever, and they were real expensive. But anyway, we got clothes. You had to have outfits then. You couldn't go out there looking like dirt balls.
Yeah.
And we sent us down to our first job was Stillwater Cave.
That actually looked like a cave, right?
It was in the real cave. It's still there.
It's still there.
Yeah, I think it was a gift shop or something. But,
and it was an actual cave.
It was a real cave, yeah. It's a famous place.
And there's a photo of you, right?
Yeah, John's dad took that picture of us standing there playing. And then our first job on the road, we went down to Interlochen Ballroom in Fairmont. That was our first road trip, and we had to get it, you know, it was exciting. We had a good night that night, and I won't tell you about everything, but it was good.
Yeah. So whose idea was it to go in the studio and record a couple songs? That would be She's My Woman and I'm Not Your Stepping Stone.
Well, that would have been me, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
And was that at the basement studio of Nickel Lake Records?
No. That would be a Dub, right?
No, that was the first one was at Nickel Lake.
Was it? Okay. And
George Garrett.
Yeah.
So, Peter, what do you remember about the basement recording studio at Nickel Lake Records?
I remember that George Garrett had a huge wart on his face or his chin. I mean, the thing was so goddamn big that I just kept thinking, why don't you go have this thing burned off or frozen off or something? God, it was huge.
You're growing a second head, goddammit.
That's that. And, but I mean, he had some real success. I mean, Christ, didn't he record The Trashman? And
yes.
He had one other. Didn't he have another one?
Underbeats, Greg D. Everybody recorded
it. Yeah, yeah.
I think
Six
Days on the Road, too.
Can you describe what that studio looked like or what kind of equipment they had?
No, I can't. It was downstairs in the basement. It was small. I remember that. Phil, maybe you guys can help out a little bit. I can't remember.
I remember the room and being there. And the downstairs and dark and, you know, and small, but I don't had any knowledge at all of recording equipment at all.
Yeah,
So the first record by the Stillbroken comes out in, I believe it's 1966, and that's on the Falcon label.
Huh?
How did you come up with that name, Peter?
Just grasping for straws. I had to get something fast. I was going to the pressing plant because the first issue is just type, just says Falcon. And then somebody told me that there was a Falcon Records out of Texas, which I still don't know or believe or care, but I thought maybe I better drop it and get another label name, which became August, because I didn't want to have trouble with some goofball in Dallas, let's say, that said, hey, I got the Falcon label long before you were in business. You know, I didn't want to go through it, so that's all.
Do you remember how many copies of that first 45 were pressed up?
Oh, I think your initial pressing was 1,000. It would be 10 boxes of 100, I believe, or and something like that, yeah.
So when the record came out, what did you do to promote it?
I actually did what you normally would do, which was mail them out to all the radio stations, talk to all the various people that would could hype things. At the time, there was a newsletter called Connie's Insider, and if you have copies of that, that's worthy of keeping. I think that they're pretty much of a treasure, and I think maybe I put a little ad in there, but I couldn't get any traction on that.
Did you get it on the air at all?
I can Phil, did we get it on the air?
I don't think so.
I don't think, we might have out in the boonies.
But not with WDGY
or KDWD, no.
Now on that 45, it says produced by the Creative Group Company.
Well, that's because I was still employed either at DGY or KDWB, and I just didn't want to have somebody coming in and saying, you're fired because of this. So that's why I did it.
But it wasn't me. You didn't want your name on the record because you were still a DJ at the time.
Right, right. And I'm raising kids at the time and, you know, I'm just trying to make a buck, you know. Mm-hmm. There's nothing special going on.
So then it's only a year later when the group goes to Dove Recording in Bloomington and records Hey Joe back with Sunny Day, which also comes out on Falcon. And what happens when this record comes out?
Well, it got a lot of action, but it surrounded the Twin Cities. I mean, it was Des Moines and Fargo and Sioux Falls and Duluth and Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls and, you know, all the way you would surround the Twin Cities. And then finally, some calls came in to God Don't You Love Him, Johnny Canton, who was the music director at DGY at the time. And he called me up. He said, Peter, I know this is your record. Well, actually, I think I'm on that one. And he said, is this bullshit? He said, we're getting so many calls on this record. I said, Johnny, I swear to God, you are not set up on this thing at all. Well, then in the meantime, I'm running downtown Minneapolis with records in my car and giving them to the music stores to stock the damn record. And that worked. And it worked big. And both the AM rockers played the record. And the only thing about it that's just criminal is that I didn't know how to produce a record for nothing.
Well, you must have done something right. It was so popular.
Yeah, it was a piece of junk, though. But not the musicians, the production. You know, and all you got to do is just take the snares off the damn drum. Leave one snare, you know, and you got it. And this thing is so full of snares, it's just like, it's just awful. And, of course, I didn't know that.
So you were doing all the distribution on your own. You didn't have a company doing the
distribution. No, I had Dart. I had Dart in the Twin Cities, finally. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, Dart was the distributor.
Yeah. Yeah, and
so they would get it to the outstate places.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they bought quite a few copies. I remember I think I made when it was all said and done after returns and the rest of it. I think I made $2,100 or $2,200 on the whole deal. But remember now, I'm paying for all the pressing and, you know, maybe it was more. I can't remember.